and welcome to The Neighbor Next Door, a podcast about the power and importance of neighboring. I'm your host, Matthew Johnson, and this is part two of our interview with Cormac Russell. Cormac is a leading voice and teacher in asset-based community development, and he is the author of the book Rekindling Democracy. We interviewed Cormac, and he's brilliant. The interview was an hour long, and for our little minds, it was helpful to break it up into chunks. So you can find the first part of this interview if you haven't heard it already. And today we dive in to part two, but maybe just a little recap. Adam, you mind catching them up?
Yeah, so the first episode of the interview with Cormac, we talked a little bit about the false dichotomy around institutions versus community and how people will often say institutions are in some way against community or community is against institutions. And we broke down that myth a little bit. Talked about the role of professionals and how professionals have a certain role in community building. And if they overstep that role, it can be detrimental to community building. And how at the atomic level, if you look at democracy, the neighborhood is the atomic kind of like building block of what makes up democracy, which of course works really well for us as the neighboring movement. I'm super pumped about that. So today we're gonna kind of pick up there's two sections of the interview that we're gonna play. We're gonna play one that is about the world as it is and describing kind of the neighborhood as it is. And then we'll interrupt the interview and have a little conversation. And then we'll play a second part of the interview, which is talking about how do we create the world as we wish it to be. And so we're gonna jump in here, starting with Cormac giving us a little bit about what his perception is of the world as it is.
How you begin to, in the world as it is, rather than in the world as we wish it to be, to have a conversation about that is the important thing. Now, the world as it is a world where our places have not really been very well regarded by most, especially by people I suppose we would have hoped might know better. So certainly from, I would say, the early part of the 80s in North America and Europe, in Australia and so forth, there's been what I feel is a massive shift away from the idea that we are our neighbors, sisters, kind of communities, keepers, and that we've got to kind of watch out for each other, be there for each other. There have been moments when we've been reminded of that, most recently COVID-19, the pandemic, but it has felt like there's been a real shift and quite a heightening through globalization of this individualism and the separateness or the atomizing of neighborhoods and how we experience them. But also at the same time, it's felt like a lot of the professions that might have remained rooted in the neighborhood, so have an allegiance to the neighborhood, have now shifted their allegiance away from the place and to either other people in their guild or in their professions or specialisms or, you know, their discipline, you know. And I think that's one of the really difficult issues with police killings and dealing with them. So that the core of the issue is if you've got institutional racism and you've got a set of people who are, you know, who have allegiance to other people who wear the same uniform as them, how do you even get in on that stuff? Whereas if you've got allegiance to the people you serve and the place you serve, then there's some possibilities. It's the same with policy. So the world as it is at the moment, and that's what I'm trying to speak into in the book, because I need to be able to speak to people who at this current point in time may want to do something different, but want a more compelling story than the one that they find themselves in. So there's something about saying, well, are you a policymaker who has been trying out what I call place-less policies, you know, policies that could just as easily be applied to the left side of Mars as, you know, downtown Seattle or LA or, you know, Dublin for that of it. And a lot of people would say, yes, we are. You know, we're expected to work with silos, with specialisms, with pathologies, is the case in point. So you take Milwaukee, are doing something to really try and move into this idea of the neighborhood as the primary unit of change, with their recent strategies around law enforcement, where they're reinterpreting crime and they're saying, well, it's a public health issue. And actually what we need to do is we need to work in the neighborhoods where we have the highest crime rates, because these are markers of poverty. These are markers of social injustice. These are markers of racial inequity. And the only way to deal with this is to not defund the police in that kind of glib sense, but to take money away from the budget line that says enforce, 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 which is a form of human sacrifice, and particularly racist human sacrifice, and move it into a public health narrative that says, let's employ community builders in the neighborhoods, from the neighborhoods, who themselves are going to actually co-create what makes sense to them. You know, what does safety look like? What does health look like? And what does equity look like? And I think that relocation of authority, that relocation of democracy, is really significant in my mind and essential.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there in that little, you know, 3-4 minute clip of the interview that we have. I think the thing that sticks out in my mind with that is when we've witnessed people in our neighborhoods, or even people like in my church, or people who are in my professional life, and really many settings, who have bought into this mentality where whatever issue or problem or need I come up against must be solved by an outside professional. That there's some person who if I wanted the problem to be solved, I would have to pay some professional, to some expert, to come in from the outside and solve it on our behalf. And that I think is a myth that is untrue, that we have to break down before we can really start to create and rekindle democracy at that neighborhood level.
Mm-hmm. For me, what stands out in that clip that obviously is related is then how it's a false narrative that's fueled on both sides.
Yeah.
Right, that it's fueled on the side of the resident, right? The neighbor who lives in the neighborhood, who's being told, you know, you don't have enough training, or you don't have the gifts necessary to be able to address, right, this problem. Mm-hmm. That authority is taken away. But then there's also, you know, the opposite side of that coin that is told to professionals. And I see myself in that category.
Yeah.
All right. Like the way that he links it to not being located in the place. So instead of having allegiance to the place, it's the neighborhood. I like that, you know, it's allegiance. And mm-hmm. it's instead rooted in the guild, or, you know, the professional gathering, which then I think it doubly harms the neighborhood.
Right.
And I'm thinking about, and this is to me a truly tragic example. Not that his weren't. I mean, right, obviously linking this to institutional racism and police killings, right, is tremendously important. But I see the same thing with pastors.
Mm-hmm.
That the pastors are put in churches, and the narrative within denominations is, you must do what you can to build, to increase the size of this church.
Right.
For lack of a better word. And it doesn't matter if you're harming the neighborhood in that process, as long as the church is growing, as opposed to having pastors in communities where we're saying, we want you to only do things that are good for the overall health of this community.
Hmm.
which is where you make that shift to ABCD, right? It's asset-based at that point, because it's about, well, how do I foster good health in this community and trust that, generally speaking, that will be better for this congregation? So I think we could probably find other specific examples of this.
It's not an easy pill to swallow for people like you and I who've been schooled and trained in the professional helping world, mm-hmm. because that, I mean, in many ways, it's literally the salary of many of our friends and colleagues, right. is built out of that system. And we're not trying to like call into question the like validity of their work. And I love that Cormack talks about this recentering is the language that he uses around that. So mm-hmm. we're recentering the place of that work so that it is no longer the center of how change happens in the neighborhood. And instead, the citizen, the resident, the person, the neighbor becomes the center of that. And so the place we move to in the conversation then is, well, how does that actually work then? If we are going to recenter democracy into the neighborhood, what are the kind of tactics and skills that we need to have to do that? So this next part of the conversation will lead us into that.
Now, I can do the work I like doing. I could write a book that I like about the work I like doing, which is community work. But if I ignore the fact that we live in a world that currently is experiencing this massive amount of space invasion from outside policymakers and professionals who are largely coming in and harvesting people by their dysfunction or their pathology as defined by them, and then segregating them into, you know, classes like all the older people go to a certain place, all the youth at risk, as they're called, I hate the term, go to another place and so on. Well, first of all, that's the opposite of building community. And second of all, it's counterproductive. So there's little point in me saying, right, you're the bad guys, get off the road. So what I want to say is that what we're talking about here is a three-lane highway. And in the first lane is a whole set of things communities can do. So this isn't all on you. But they can't do that stuff if you keep putting them down. You can't lift them up by putting them down, right? There's a second lane where there's a whole set of things they can do with you, but we need to actually really get some clarity around, we've got to support them to discover what they have first and then supplement that. And then the final lane is, you know, things that can be done for communities. Now, the question might be, what's the scale at which you could do that work? We know city is too big. We certainly know state is too big. Region is too big. So what's the scale? We know family is too small. We know individual is just, that is really not helpful. So we've really tried, we've cast the die on individual behavior change. Behavioral economics, I think, it is coming near the end of its day, and it can't really go quickly enough, in my opinion. And institutional reform is a busted flush, you know, because now we all know the truth about institutional racism. So this idea that institutions will suck salvation from their own thumb has been pretty much exposed, you know. So I think there's a third unit of change, and that's the neighborhood, which interestingly isn't a violent or a revolutionary scale, because it says the good news is the individual can be included here. And if you're an institution that really wants to serve, you can actually find a way out of your silo and into something much broader. You can go from an enforcement issue to a social justice issue. And isn't that what you woke up imagining you'd be doing when you were 16, except maybe for the people who just like, you know, having guns on their holsters. But I mean, most other people who want to really serve, I think, joined this work for a reason. So the book, long-winded answer, but the book's an attempt to have a conversation that really gets us beyond narratives like the public. And we're hearing this a lot at the moment with COVID. We're trying to engage with the public. There is no such thing as the public, nor is there such thing as individual. You know, you can't speak to 350 or 400 million individuals either. Although with marketing, I suppose it can be done, but you know, it's not something that we can negotiate. For example, the uptake of vaccines around. We need to move into a conversation that's about culture, that is respectful of diversity, but that also is a scale at which we can move things forward. And I think the neighborhood is not the only unit of scale, but it is an important one, a primary one perhaps, and certainly one that's been maybe not as well regarded as I think it needs to be.
Okay, so before we go any further, we've got to talk about Cormac's way with words. I mean, this guy, he's talking about how institutions are harvesting people by their pathologies, which let's just like break that down for a second. Like
right.
Pathologies, if you're gonna Google it or something.
Yeah.
If you need to, if you don't know what it means.
In other words, you've Googled it, right? You're pulling it up right now, right?
I probably should have done that because I was gonna just wing it and give a definition. But now I'm afraid that if I do that, I'll be mocked in the comment section of our podcast. So, but basically it's like, this is being defined by the need or the thing that you could be labeled as, right? So like right. You, the label or the diagnosis even of your need mm-hmm. and lumping people together like that, like he says, we put the old people over here. We put the, you know, the youth, the at-risk youth over here, and we put them into these little silos mm-hmm. and then we harvest them mm-hmm. and we're going to talk more about this a little bit later too of institutions basically raising their salaries out of the needs of those pathologies, which is gross. And then he talks about institutional reform is a busted flush, and they will not find salvation by sucking their own thumb. Oh my God. Like that's so great.
It is so great.
Yeah.
The poetic power of what he's teaching here. And I think it makes me laugh. I think that's kind of my reaction, but I also want to kind of hold the, let's go back to the phrase harvesting people by their pathologies. Right. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. that's deeply dehumanizing. It's very graphic. I mean, that sounds like a phrase from an alien movie, right? Does. Right? Or The Matrix, right? Like,
yeah,
just going to plug you in and harvest your body's energy or whatever. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And yet, and that's, I mean, it's very, very appropriate, right? Because these institutions, which were started to address, you know, to ease people's problems. I mean, I think, mm-hmm. you know, like, and that's where it's again, like going back to what we talked about in episode one with our interview, like we're not anti-institutional. Most institutions have that history of coming from a really genuine place of caring for people. They hired people who really care about people and want to make a difference in the world. But there's some other fault lines, I think, in our society that then it ends up getting inverted. And in order for the institution to survive, rather than actually removing the problem or the brokenness, they need to like cultivate more of that problem. Like the more broken people there are, then the more grant money we can get. And then you know, we can grow.
And I mean, to go back to like the threat of our salaries that we've put on the line here, you know, for institutional people who are in that needs-based helping profession, I like what he says about this is not a violent revolution.
Yeah.
And the neighborhood has space for the individuals and for the institutional professional.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference is, instead of enforcing around needs and pathologies, we're going to decenter that priority and recenter this role of calling for justice and bringing about that order in a neighborhood that allows the neighborhood to be sufficient without the institution. And that actually does give me hope. That is what I woke up at 16, you know, dreaming that I would be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think my hope is that institutional professionals hear that as hopeful, not as only critique. It is critique. There's no way around it. But my guess is, because I know a lot of these people and love them, mm-hmm. they're tired of serving the need. They're tired of trying to figure out another need to go raise money around.
Yeah.
They're tired of that.
Yeah.
And so this does give hope, because it gives us that way of saying, oh, that's, I misinterpreted my job. Mm-hmm. And now I have another way of seeing it.
Yes. Yeah. And I also, I do want to take a moment then also to nuance his point. Well, not to nuance, but to clarify his point. That so, you know, institutional reform is a bust, but also the size of change, it can't just be the individual.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is something from Cormack that is just really compelling to me, because I have just been so deeply entrenched in the idea that if you want to change society, okay, you can't change the federal government, but let's change individual behavior.
Right.
And actually, that's too small.
Yeah.
Right. It's and like, I think there has to be transformation on the individual level. I still hold on to that belief. But what he points out is it's the neighborhood. That's the scale. And from part one of our interview, you know, that would be, we're talking about 3,000, 4,000 people, something like that. Right. Think of a village. That's mm-hmm. the level of change. And if we can, explore that unit, then we can start to see, I think, something really powerful happen.
So. Yeah, the scale of all this is fascinating to me. And one of the things I've been thinking a lot about lately is the way that so many of our cultural norms have broken down in the last several years with rise of authoritarianism, rise, and then the pandemic. So many of those norms have broken down. Now, here's the thing. Some of those norms were not helpful. some of them were actually like needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in a space right now where I think there's not enough defined norms for us to have kind of a stable point.
Mm.
And so we need to rebuild some of those. Mm-hmm. And what he's pointing to at scale is that the place where those norms get created is in the neighborhood. That's the level it gets created. And if we think that it's going to be legislated from the United States Congress, or if we think that it's going to be dreamed up all on my own in my journal, then we're wrong. It's not going to happen in those spaces.
Yeah,
it's created organically from the grassroots in a neighborhood scale.
Yes. Yeah. And gosh, I mean, we're going to circle back to this again and again, but like it happens block by block. It happens with the act of welcoming your neighbor who's new to the block and getting to know your neighbor's names and discovering their gifts. And it seems, that seems too small, but it's establishing the culture within the community with yes. those direct acts. And, you know, and I don't know, the theory that's emerging in my mind is, I think part of the reason that people are so mistrustful or doubtful of government is because because of that placeless policy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, that doesn't, I don't know how that applies or fits here. And there's not a sense of the bridge from like, here's how we do it in my neighborhood. And then that expanded into my city. And then that expanded into my state and then into my country. And so, but we just all, it, so that gets really big, really fast, but it actually just goes back to that. How did I treat my neighbors today?
Yep. Hmm. Yeah. You know, it'd be great if there was like a group or a podcast or something like that, that would like curate stories about how that happens.
Gosh, that's a brilliant idea, Adam.
Yeah, you know, maybe Jenna, our editor, could link that in the descriptions, you know, of some group or like a movement maybe that was doing that work. But no, seriously, you know, think about if you were a regular listener, our episode with Midland, the group from Midland, Michigan, of their city government working with a group of citizens to do this work, right? Yeah. Like that happened there. The next episode of this series in the interview with Cormac is going to be some stories of how this plays out in real life and how that balance has been struck and done well in communities. And so we're going to hear that this isn't just ideas. This is happening in the world. Hmm. And that's why we think it is a movement.
Yes. Oh man, well, I can't wait to hear it.
Well, you and everyone else will have to wait till next week. So.
All right. Well, as always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Neighbor Next Door. You can find out more about the neighboring movement by visiting our website, neighboringmovement.org. And feel free to reach out. If you have stories or insights that you'd like to share, we would love to hear from you. You can reach me at matt@neighboringmovement.org. Until next time, happy neighboring.
Happy neighboring.